From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It began at a congressional hearing about network coverage of November's election night fiasco. California Democrat Henry Waxman had heard a rumor that Jack Welch, chairman of General Electric Company, which owns NBC, had been rooting in the newsroom for George W. Bush and even pressuring news staffers to call the close race for Bush. Waxman had further been told that there was a videotape made by NBC's promotions department capturing indicting evidence of Welch's interference. At the hearing, he asked then-NBC News President Andrew Lack if such a tape existed. Lack, under oath, said if he could find such a tape, he would send it to Waxman. More than 9 months later, in spite of a spate of increasingly sharp official correspondence and a not-too-veiled threat about a congressional subpoena, no tape has been delivered. Congressman Waxman joins us now. Congressman, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
All right. Why do we care?
I think we should care for two reasons. One, we don't know, and this tape may tell us, whether he, in fact, pressured the news people to make the decision rather than have the news people make the decision. Secondly, NBC uses the public airwaves. They have a public responsibility. Even if they're owned by General Electric, there has to be some kind of separation between the corporate ownership and the news people.
Andrew Lack, well, I guess from your perspective, maddeningly refusing to actually address your direct questions, does in some of his correspondence make a trenchant point. And he says that all of the networks relying on the same voter news service data called the election for George W. Bush within moments of one another. So doesn't that mean ipso facto that the real problems were elsewhere on election night and the Welch situation is provocative but basically just a red herring?
You could look at it that way. And maybe the tape would show that Jack Welch just happened to be in the room and nothing went on. But NBC was second to call the election for Bush. And we ought to have this thing resolved by knowing what is on that tape.
Understanding that this is supposedly a promotional video we're discussing, not
That's
part
right.
of the news gathering process, shouldn't I still be queasy about the government compelling a network to turn over any material? Isn't there a very serious First Amendment issue here?
I don't think this is a question of the government asking for a tape of the internal deliberations of the news people, and it relates to not an internal news discussion, but perhaps an external interference with the decisions by the news people at NBC.
In your last love letter to Andy Lack, you seem to be threatening NBC with a subpoena. Now, that's a can of worms. Congress just doesn't subpoena news organizations, at least not successfully. Is this situation, whatever happened there on election night, worth a constitutional battle?
It's a hypothetical whether we're going to go to a subpoena or not. The real question is, what is NBC going to do now that there's some attention being paid to this whole matter? Andy Lack has a personal responsibility to keep the promise that he made to the Congress under oath.
Oh, yeah, the under oath you also invoked in the correspondence. You're not suggesting some sort of, I don't know, contempt of Congress, perjury possibility down the road if he doesn't respond, having said he would do so under oath.
I'm suggesting that when somebody testifies before Congress and they're under oath, if they promise to give information to the Congress, they have a responsibility to do so. Now, would he be convicted of a crime for not doing it? And I don't suggest that at all. But I don't think that people ought to take oaths and then disregard them and think it's unimportant.
The whole epistolary exchange between you guys has been, you know, pretty hilarious. Obviously, the stakes are high, but the correspondence is a lot of fun to read. You know, it's ultra polite. You're very respectful of one another, but it gets increasingly confrontational. Congressman, who actually writes your letters? He or she is a genius.
Thank you very much. I will compliment everybody who's been involved in drafting those letters, and I take the compliment personally as well. And you might ask Mr. Lack, because it sounds like he wrote his himself. But he
responds to you without actually responding to your direct request.
I did say to him in one of my letters that if his news people accepted the kind of answer that he gave to my question, he would fire them because they're not being very good.
All right, I'll ask you one more question. In the unlikely event that NBC surrenders this videotape and it shows Jack Welch unabashedly rooting in the newsroom for George W. Bush and saying to whoever's running the news desk, when are you going to call it? When are you going to call it? Then what do you do?
Well, you know, I'm not gonna speculate on that. I don't know the facts. I think we ought to know the facts, and then we'll see where the facts take us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Henry Waxman is a California Democrat and member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
This week, a Chinese court found internet entrepreneur Wang Qi guilty of subversion for posting articles on his website promoting democracy and human rights. According to a watchdog group called the Digital Freedom Network, roughly 10 people in China have become political prisoners because of their actions on the net. In 3 years, China's internet users have climbed from 2 million to 23 million. China responds with new filtering and monitoring software and crackdowns that have closed some 8,000 internet cafes this year. Not long ago, President Clinton observed that China's effort to control the internet was like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. But so far it seems the Jell-O is staying put. Several new studies reported recently in the Christian Science Monitor suggest that rather than flooding China with Western ideas, the internet is actually expanding the control of the Chinese authorities. We're joined now by author and China specialist Orville Schell. Mr. Schell, we've always been told that it's impossible to regulate political expression on the internet, that it can't be done. Is China doing it?
Well, China's really on the horns of quite a dilemma. On the one hand, it has recognized that it desperately needs the internet for business purposes. But at the same time, it's very circumspect about the political consequences of an unfettered internet. So that in what it's tried to do, as in so much of the rest of the reform agenda, is to separate what it views as the good from the bad. And it wants economic reform, but not political reform. And on the internet, it wants the facility the internet provides for business and commerce, but it doesn't want the facility it also provides for political expression and interchange.
Isn't the toothpaste out of the tube for China? I've read that the number of internet users in the country doubled in the first 8 months of this year to roughly 17 million, and that the Chinese are buying PCs at a faster rate than anywhere else in Asia.
I think it is true, but at the same time, more and more people are going online. There is also a very concerted effort to both block websites abroad that are considered unfavorable to the Chinese Communist Party, but also in some measure as well to oversee and regulate email traffic by looking for keywords, by making people register to get online, even if they go into one of China's many internet cafes.
Do you happen to know what any of those keywords might be?
Well, I think there are many obvious ones. Words such
Falun Gong as Falun Gong might be one.
Falun Gong would be one. Democracy, dissidents, human rights, Tibet, Taiwan. Any of these words might be ones on the list. And it's very common that you'll be looking at a chat room and you'll see some rather outrageous statements pop up, and then a few minutes later they're gone. I mean, in a certain sense, this is really the experiment of all experiments and well worth watching. Is it inherently so democratic that it can't be controlled? Now, the other, of course, aspect of control that's worth watching is the commercial one, because you have to also acknowledge that it does not behoove a commercial enterprise to make trouble by having disturbing political sites or messages coming through that venue. So, AOL moving into China, they're not going to cram down the throats of the Communist Party websites of human rights groups. Murdoch got rid of the BBC. So there is a self-censoring mechanism also at work, which tends to aid the party's efforts to delete sites and information that they consider dangerous.
That's fascinating, because it seems to contradict the conventional wisdom that if you open up the markets, then you're bound to let the principles of democracy trickle through along with it.
Well, I think that's a somewhat spurious and incomplete notion. I think free markets can certainly aid and abet free expression, but they do not ipso facto lead to free expression. There are examples of authoritarian regimes which are not democratic, but have very robust and very dynamic free market systems. One would look at Germany during the war, Italy, Chile under Pinochet. I mean, there have been a lot of notable examples of successful markets that do not highly esteem or allow self-expression or a very high degree of democracy.
Orville Schell, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Orville Schell is a professor of Far Eastern History and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. 2 years ago, a Shanghai computer company owner named Lin Hai became China's first internet-related political prisoner when he gave 30,000 email addresses to a pro-democracy group based in the United States. He never saw himself as especially political, but his perspective was shaped, he says, when he was a college student in 1989, present at the bloody uprising in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
On the June 4th, at that day, I see an 8-year-old boy was dead, and his mother crying in our campus. So this is really hit my heart.
At one time, you hoped to be the next Bill Gates, you've said. Do you still feel that way?
It's a common dream for Chinese students learning IT, computer science. But I think right now it's impossible.
What is your dream now?
First dream, I think I want to live in peacefully. And the second dream, I want to see all people in China living peacefully.
And do you think the internet can help get them there?
Sure, because the network is turning to the new media and it will push China to more freedom.
Lin Hai, do you regret what happened to you?
No.
Why not?
I think everybody cannot control his own fate. I'm just a network engineer, and I have never think about to be speaking here right now. But something chose me. I think it's the fate of me.
Now an update. In May, on the media, all right, it was Brooke, interviewed a representative from the Rocky Mountain Media Watch. That Denver-based organization had just petitioned the FTC to rule that local TV news broadcasts shouldn't be allowed to call themselves news. The Rocky Mountain Media Watch suggested that Mayhem, Fluff, Weather, and Sports would be a more suitable title. This week, the FTC officially disagreed. The Trade Commission said there was no evidence that consumers assumed that news necessarily means hard news. And even if a consumer did think all news had to be hard, the FTC said they could turn to the internet, cable, or a newspaper. The FTC has remained mum on the issue of whether reruns of Chips and Mama's Family truly make TBS a super station.
Coming up, product replacement in the movies and product displacement on TV. Also, Garfield crosses the pond in pursuit of fame.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Enid, the main character in the new movie Ghost World, says that she can't relate to 99% of humanity. One reason is that her tastes run counter to a world outfitted by The Gap and fueled by venti mocha frappuccinos. Enid and her friend, the fanatical collector Seymour, both love obscure music, retro clothing, and quirky art. The characters in Ghost World don't have a problem with their recondite tastes, but the makers of Ghost World did have a problem with putting those tastes on the screen. Director Terry Zwigoff himself had a large collection of memorabilia that he wanted to shoot, but because of legal clearances, that was impossible. In fact, rights and clearances proved to be a big issue in bringing the Dan Clowes comic book to the multiplex, as the producer of Ghost World, Leanne Halfin, had to deal with all of these legal headaches. She joins us now. Most listeners know that you have to get clearances to play bits of music in movies, but do you have to get it for props too?
Yeah, you have to get it really for everything that's in the film. Anything that's seen on camera has to be cleared. And part of the difficulty with Ghost World was that we had two different sides. One was all the pop culture that both Seymour and Enid deride through the movie, and the other side was the stuff that Seymour collects, which Enid adores.
If you can't establish a line of ownership, can you just say, look, there's no way to prove who owns it, and then put it in the movie?
You used to be able to do that. That was called due diligence, and I was absolutely counting on that as a defense when I presented this to the insurance company. Unfortunately, there have been so many suits because the studios are considered to have deep pockets that you can no longer get that insurance.
So what couldn't you use from Terry's collection?
God, you know, when they say 99% of humanity, it was like 99% of Terry's collection we couldn't use. He had these dolls from cats that looked like an earlier version of Crazy Cat from the 30s, and I had to hide them on the set because they kept popping up further and further back in the bookcase, but they kept popping up, and I knew that there were going to be a red flag for our lawyer. The World of Henry Orient was a movie that both Dan and I had seen in our childhood, and it had been a kind of an inspiration. And we wanted to put that movie poster in Enid's room. And when you get the rights to the poster, you not only have to get the rights to the movie, you have to get the release from the studio, but you also actually have to get the likeness clearance. You have to have that person say, yes, that's okay.
So Peter Sellers' heirs would have to say it's okay.
Right. So we went through and we got an okay on everybody except one character. And so there is either a tennis racket or a, you know, some sort of stuffed animal in front of the face of that one character.
You know, another peculiarity of all of this is that the massive commercialism of the world weighed down heavily on the characters, and you wanted to picture that. But you couldn't show all the signs for fast food, say, that a person would normally pass as he walked down the street.
Yeah, in fact, the initial credit sequence, which Terry and Dan had designed, was a montage of these fast food signs and a kind of crushing bleakness. I knew we wouldn't be able to use all of it, but I thought we could use a certain amount of it. And we couldn't use anything, because unless you can put the stuff in the background, which it isn't, you know, we're trying to say that it's encroaching, and unless you can put it so far in the background and say that you're not commenting, then you can't use it. And so, for example, you know, initially we wanted to shoot, Rebecca was working in a Starbucks. You know, Terry and Dan really wanted her to be in a Starbucks, and Starbucks said, of course, no.
How frustrating was all of this for Terry?
He was tremendously pissed off, and it's not a rare thing to hear Terry say, you're killing me.
He's directed documentaries. Did he have to go through these same clearance problems in the other films he's done?
You know, there's no such thing as errors and omissions insurance when you're making a documentary.
And errors and omission insurance.
Which means that you buy insurance that keeps somebody who was walking in the background or somebody who says, I designed that poster. Did you get the clearance? And if you didn't, do you have to pay me now?
So here's a film about culture. Or the clash of cultures, or passionate cultural preferences. And yet all this imagery that you need in a film proved to be, is it fair to say, the biggest hurdle?
I think it was one of the biggest hurdles. You know, what the studio said is, you know, we were sort of boxed in, and I said, what do you expect me to do? You read the script. What did you think I was going to put in the room? And they said, make it up. And I said, like what? Like make fake signs, make fake dolls. And on the budget, first of all, you know, your audience is completely aware of the fact that it's not real.
Well, you made a fake Starbucks.
We did make a fake Starbucks, but part of the reason was, and it was became a kind of a conceptual idea, is I never really wanted to shoot in Starbucks anyway, because I didn't want the target to be Starbucks in particular, or, you know, Banana Republic in particular. We wanted to say that there were 100 places like this, and whether it's called the Coffee Experience or Java Juice or Starbucks is not really the point. It's not the fact that it's big, it's that it's omnipresent.
So the stuff that the character Seymour, which is sort of a stand-in for Terry Zwigoff, the stuff that he doesn't like, you didn't feel the same compulsion to name as he did the stuff he truly loved.
Yes. Part of the reason he doesn't like it is that it becomes a blur. And the stuff that he likes for its particularness.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leanne Halfin is the producer of Ghost World.
With product placement on my mind, I was reading the newsletter from NPR member station KCRW, and I quote, Our friends at UPP Entertainment Marketing, the nation's premier product placement firm, have been working on a pro bono basis to get our name out there, and they're doing a great job. Look for KCRW mugs in upcoming episodes of Ally McBeal, The Practice, Felicity, Family Law, That's Life, Emerald, Pasadena, and 23 Minutes and 12 Seconds. Ally McBeal and The Practice take place in Boston. Felicity and That's Life take place in New York. And nobody's ever heard of those other shows. So I called the president of UPP, Greg Mezzatesta, who mentioned that KCRW was also looking at The West Wing and Law and Order. My point exactly. Why would someone in Boston, New York, or Washington, D.C. have a mug from a radio station in Santa Monica, California?
Of course, all of those shows, even though they're set outside of Southern California, actually tape in Southern California. So as long as the directors and producers are fans of the brand and, you know, see a creative congruity, it works. And KCRW does reach those other marketplaces via the Internet.
Very good. And look for the Morning Edition Chevy, which will be competing in an upcoming NASCAR event near you.
As we speak, British journalists are twiddling their thumbs in bored anticipation of an event that is as inevitable as rain on an English summer's day. Not to put too fine a point on it, they're waiting for the Queen Mum to die. The death watch began when the 101-year-old royal suffered a fainting spell and retreated to a remote castle in Scotland.
There hasn't been a big royal funeral in England since 1952, when the present Queen's father died amid all the pomp and glory the British Empire could then afford. The BBC covered that one, of course, and will cover the next. Tim Luckhurst is an ex-BBC producer and has written an article in The Guardian newspaper called "Please God, Not on My Shift." Tim, if, God forbid, Tony Blair were to drop dead jogging tomorrow, what would happen?
If Blair keels over while jogging right now, the coverage will just be the way that the BBC or any other broadcast would normally cover a big event, i.e. with objectivity and a degree of interest for the public. But don't expect anything like that if the Queen Mother dies, which is, let's face it, rather more likely.
All right, if the Queen Mother should pass away right now, I presume the BBC jumps right on the story and goes on the air with the bulletin and then lets nature take its course, right?
Absolutely no way. Because, you see, the BBC's coverage of a royal death is governed by a set of regulations called the Royal Death Guidelines, which are drummed into every BBC executive almost from the moment they join the corporation. And one of the key commitments in those guidelines is that the BBC will honour any embargo that the palace wishes to place upon announcement of royal death. What that means, quite simply, is that if the Queen Mother dies and Buckingham Palace has decided not to announce the fact that she's dead, then the BBC won't announce the fact that she's dead either. It's that simple.
It's 2001. Why in the world would the modern BBC stick to this fairly ancient embargo that seems to be antithetical to all the principles of modern journalism?
It's an exceptionally fair question, and many people in the BBC wonder as well. The simple answer is that the BBC, quite simply, is terrified of upsetting Buckingham Palace, and it will therefore drop all journalistic objectivity the moment the Queen Mother dies, or at least 3 hours afterwards, if that's when Buckingham Palace decides it's fit to announce the information.
What about the BBC's viewers and listeners? ITV isn't subject to the embargo. Sky News isn't subject to the embargo.
Right.
I mean,
the BBC's
CNN.
Guidelines say, and I'm reading now absolutely verbatim from the text, the BBC will honour any such embargo regardless of what other broadcasters may do. Now, the BBC knows full well what other broadcasters will do. They'll treat it as a news story, and they'll break the news as quickly as possible and seek to assess it. And I suspect that the majority are going to be outraged by the way the BBC behaves.
Every major news organization has an obituary file of prepared stories ready should some prominent figure of some age or frailty expire. Obviously, the BBC is prepared for the Queen Mother to die, but how prepared?
Well, this isn't just the standard obituary on file, which, as you say, every broadcaster would have for most significant figures in national life. This is a complete set of reports already compiled, carefully vetted and approved for national hearing. Most of these things have already been recorded. Most of them are in a cupboard at the television centre, and everybody who has responsibility for BBC output knows where that cupboard is and knows the precise order to follow, and they will follow it. They will follow it to the letter.
This reminds me of when, you know, some sort of Soviet, when Brezhnev died.
Yes, well, remember that George Orwell, it was, who compared the BBC to the Soviet state. 1984 was, in fact, based on the rituals and internal bureaucracy of Broadcasting House. That is undisputed and a product of his experience of working as producer for the BBC. But it has to be said, nothing else in the BBC's news coverage would be treated in that way.
Is there any aspect of this which is a straw man, where the BBC is going to rigorously follow this policies, knowing in advance that people are going to, at a minimum, roll their eyes and maybe be outraged by this kind of anachronistic way of handling a royal death? Are they doing this in order to foment criticism so they can get back to normal journalism?
Well, the answer is simple. There are a lot of people inside the BBC who think this is exceptionally silly. I mean, ludicrous, in the words of one of my former colleagues who I spoke to when writing this piece. But there's a section of the population which would be black affronted if we didn't treat this like the end of civilization. So although lots of them resent it, they're going to treat it like the end of civilization. And then, as the same executive said to me, when we've made ourselves look majestically absurd, the whole strategy will be reviewed and subjected to the dictates of common sense. In other words, they'll never do it again.
All right, well, Tim Luckhurst, my condolences in advance. I hope well in advance, and thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Tim Luckhurst is a columnist and former newspaper editor whose column in the Guardian newspaper was titled, "Please God, Not on My Shift."
The Queen Mother of England, of course, holds a special place in the hearts of Britons. But do you know her name? It happens to be Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Lyon Windsor, but you probably didn't know that. Here in the colonies, we don't have much cause to recognize Mum's name, or the names of scores of others who have earned fame over there. As Bob discovered, our British cousins have lately developed an extremely low threshold for defining celebrity.
You've looked after loads of celebrities, yeah. Made them up.
Yeah.
Which one's your favourite? Who's your favourite?
Oh, God, there's loads. I do loads, but I really like Gail Port. She's absolutely brilliant. I do Melanie Sykes, Melinda Messenger.
Oh,
I mean,
God, just
all ranges. You know,
Gail Porter, Melanie Sykes, and Melinda Messenger. Who in the world are Gail Porter, Melanie Sykes, and Melinda Messenger? They're nobody. That's who they are. Great Britain is at the moment so painfully bereft of world-class celebrities that their demi-celebrity chat show hostesses are reduced to interviewing demi-celebrity hairdressers about the demi-celebrity entertainers whom you almost certainly have never heard of. For a country that produced Richard Burton, Julie Andrews, 007 Sean Connery, Princess Diana, and the Beatles, the current celebrity drought is an embarrassment and a heartbreak.
Any time you went to an event, you always knew you had to put your best dinner suit and bow tie on. It's been a long time since I wore a dinner suit and a bow tie.
Richard Young is a freelance celebrity photographer who has been shooting pop stars and royalty for 40 years.
People I'm going to photograph in London doesn't really warrant it. And I look around me and I see this, the people that everybody is going mad about, and I think to myself, these are not stars. How, for crying out loud, can these people have the audacity to call themselves celebrities?
Who are the big celebrities in the United Kingdom right now?
I guess you'd say Robbie Williams, Gordon Brown.
Let me ask you a follow-up question, please. Who are Robbie Williams and Gordon Brown?
Well, one is a pop star, one's a politician.
Here's the one who isn't a politician.
Hell is gone.
The song is titled Let Me Entertain You. You can hear it on your favorite Top 40 station, Never.
Excuse me. I'm Bob Garfield from National Public Radio in Washington. Can I ask you a question? Who are your big celebrities?
It's got to be David Beckham's wife, yeah. Posh Spice.
Big celebrities in England. Nasser Hussain, the English cricket captain. He's one of my favourites.
I don't know, Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, American.
Yeah, Christina Ricci, Michelle Pfeiffer.
American.
Yeah, worldwide, I think most of the big actors and actresses are American.
David Beckham, I suppose, and his wife. Posh.
That's the best you can come up with.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Isn't that a pitiful state of affairs?
Sad.
It's worse than sad. It's pathetic. Whenever Britain comes up with a decent celebrity, Anthony Hopkins, Elizabeth Hurley, say, they pick up and move to the United States, where we have Hollywood and a superior way of life. Indeed, like Russia with wheat and North Korea with rice, the Britannia that for decades exported its big stars, its music, and its fashion now is reduced to importing from the States. Madonna's arrival has given Fleet Street a chance to hound somebody significant for the first time since the death of Princess Diana. It's all a sign, says University of Sussex Media Studies professor Andy Medhurst, of a nation that is living so obsessively in the past that it has lost its grip on the present.
England's become a kind of theme park country for lots of people who visit here. They have the things they tick off. It's like Disneyland with royalty. Things they want to take home with them are the images and memories of the English past. I mean, the English present doesn't interest many people outside England.
Witness Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, a movie that spoofs the time when Britain was setting the cultural agenda for the world.
Oh, behave. Yeah. Yeah, baby! Yeah.
And he's a Canadian who's become an American pretending to be an Englishman, so there you go.
How embarrassing is that? But this tragic dearth of Indigenous celebrity resources isn't merely embarrassing. It's the final proof, after the march of the Euro, the flop of the Millennium Dome, and the U.S. military domination of the Balkan crisis, that the country that defeated the Spanish Armada, that controlled colonies on four continents, that faced down Hitler, is now completely irrelevant to the rest of the world. What Robbie Williams proves, once and for all, is that the sun has set on the British Empire. Professor Medhurst.
The days when we could claim to have sort of cultural dominance across the Atlantic certainly are long, long gone. I think what we have to do is recognize where our place on the global ladder is. And we always had a very inflated idea of where that was. And I guess now we're having to face facts. You know, we're a small island off the northwest coast of Europe, which is not a bad thing. It's just the thing that is.
They've given us their language. They've given us their common law. They've given us their muffins. Once upon a time, the British wove an exquisite tapestry of accomplishment. Now they are a faded, musty dropcloth of a former world power, and if you expect them to continue entertaining us, you can just put it out of your mind. The princess is dead. Long live Madonna.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go on.
Who are your big celebrities?
You know, I don't know at the moment. I really can't bring anyone to mind. Sorry.
Coming up, a reporter who became an environmentalist hero is accused of betraying the movement, and the man with two brows, both high and low, Don Imus.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. With On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Jane Acree and Steve Wilson thought they'd struck gold when they landed their six-figure jobs for a Fox Network station in Tampa. The husband and wife team, with 40 years of reporting experience between them, were hired to produce hard-hitting investigative series for WTTV. They began work on a four-part series about the use of the Monsanto-produced drug bovine growth hormone. The makers claim that when injected into dairy cows, the drug boosts milk productivity and increases profits for farmers. Although the hormone had passed FDA approval, it had passed with only minimum testing. Whether the drug was safe for humans was never entirely clear. As a result, Florida supermarkets made a promise to their customers that they would not sell any products with BGH, at least until the drug was proved safe. Wilson's and Acree's report proved that not only were some supermarkets breaking their promise, but that Monsanto was not willing to come clean about the potentially dangerous side effects of BGH on humans. The on-air promotions were relentless. Fox was plugging the series as, quote, the mystery in your milk. They were all set to run. And then...
Well, on the night before the series was to begin, it was a Friday night, the series was set for Monday, the fax machine spit out a letter from a very powerful New York law firm that Monsanto had hired. The letter told Fox officials it was addressed to Roger Ailes, who is the president of Fox Network News in New York. And it said to Ailes essentially that these reporters are idiots, they're scientifically incompetent, they don't understand, and they are going to be shouting fire in a crowded theater, essentially, and causing alarms that ought not to be raised.
And then the pressure came. What happened?
Well, we got two letters within the scope of a week. And the second one predicted dire consequences for Fox News if the series was to run. And we rewrote the story 83 times in an effort to make it truthful, yet to alleviate some of the concerns of our bosses. And not one of those rewrites was satisfactory. And at the end of the nine-month review process, we were fired.
Exactly 1 year ago, a Florida jury awarded you $425,000 in damages under the state's whistleblower law, but you didn't get it.
That's right. Fox is appealing the verdict because they want to get their good name back. And that is true. I am quoting the lawyer for Fox. We want our good name back. I was awarded the money as a whistleblower. And essentially what whistleblower does is if somebody has been retaliated against by their employer for either refusing to participate in an illegal activity or threatening to blow the whistle to the authorities on the illegal activity, then they can file this claim. And in our case, we were successful. And the federal authority here would be the FCC, which gives broadcasters these free licenses, basically, to generate as much money as they can make. Incredible sums are generated. And in exchange, the broadcasters are supposed to act responsibly, and they are supposed to be broadcasting in the public interest. And the basis of our suit was that to lie, distort, and slant a story is not in the public interest.
Now, you believe this information was important for the public to know, but did you hype the dangers, you know, in the Fox tradition in order to get the point across?
You know, that's a very good question, because reporters and Fox stations themselves often brag about how they foxify the news. We did not hype this. We simply attempted to report the truth, and that was that despite promises that you have been given that the grocery chains would not buy milk from cows injected with this, they are buying it. They've broken those promises.
The station claimed that you were, quote, unwilling to be objective in the story. Now, you were awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize earlier this year. Do you think, as journalists, that being aligned with an environmental movement prevents you from being objective?
That's a question that people raise. Or have you become activists or advocates? And we say, in a sense, yes, because we're advocates for people having information. That's what journalism is supposed to do. That's what journalists have a long tradition of doing.
Let me just add, one of the first things they attempted to do when they wanted to buy our silence was to pay us off, to give us what we called hush money in exchange for not telling people what the truth was. Now, you know, I think I could probably agree to keep my mouth shut about how Fox television works, because if you have a television, you can watch and see for yourself. But it went far beyond that. They wanted to buy our agreement that we would never tell anybody about what was in their milk. So I don't think it's about being an advocate for a position. It's about being an advocate for the public's right to know.
Well, you've been quoted as saying you don't think you'll ever work in television again. Do you think you've been blacklisted?
I think journalism, and I'm talking about mainstream journalism now that's run by large corporations, fewer than ever before as consolidation goes on, has made it pretty clear that, you know, people are supposed to keep their heads down and their mouths shut. Journalists are not supposed to stand up and challenge the people they work for. Meanwhile, the people they work for now are big corporations, and they look at the news now not as a public service, but as a product. And if it's going to cost you a whole lot of money in lost advertising because you offended some car maker or some big company like Monsanto, then suddenly it isn't worth it to give people that information, because from a business standpoint, you're not going to make as much money doing that.
So you think there's a sort of craven spirit that has infected the mainstream press?
I think it's laziness and cowardice. That's what I think.
There's a great deal of self-censorship, but you certainly wouldn't advocate, Steve, that people do what we do and end up unemployed and unemployable.
I'm not saying that's for everybody, except if you're asked to lie. I mean, it's like the next step down this road of nobody being able to believe what any of us say. And it's wrong, and nobody should go along with that, although they do.
Steve Wilson, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Jane Acre, thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
Steve Wilson and Jane Acre, former Fox Network employees, were the first journalists to win a whistleblower suit exactly 1 year ago this week.
10 years ago, Tom Knudsen wrote a series of articles for the Sacramento Bee that galvanized the environmental movement. The Sierra in Peril series showed an environment under siege from the man-made threats of logging, grazing, suburban sprawl, and air pollution. Knudsen's research sparked a public outcry. What followed were legislative hearings, a massive scientific study, and eventually a fundamental change in the way the U.S. Forest Service manages its land. Tom Knudsen won a Pulitzer and was hailed a hero by the environmental movement. Now, a decade later, comes a second Knudsen series. But unlike the first, this one isn't likely to get him invited to any Sierra Club dinners. The series, titled Environment, Inc., reads like an audit. Knudsen cites a litany of overspending in the country's largest environmental groups, including luxury offices for executives and expensive but ineffectual direct mail campaigns. Tom Knudsen, welcome to the show.
Ed Marston in the High Country News characterizes your articles as an attack. He says, and this is a quote, "Why, when there are so many real problems in the region, is Knudsen nitpicking a movement that is attempting to save the Western United States?" And furthermore, he calls you a sort of a turncoat. Are you a turncoat?
I'm a journalist, and I think it's the journalist's responsibility to look at all powerful institutions. We've historically looked at government, industry, unions, police. If you look at the Western landscape, the environmental movement exerts financial and political power. I think that it's just our job as the news media not to pledge allegiance to that movement, altruistic as it may be, but to scrutinize it.
The whole tempest raises actually some interesting questions, because you wonder if the very fact that the environmental movement is so disturbed, even outraged by your series, suggests that they've become accustomed not only to sympathetic reporting, but uncritical reporting from the media. Do you think the media in general are sort of in the pockets of the Greens?
We have been overly sympathetic. I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is just kind of the nature of the business. It's a business that lives in part on controversy. Environmental groups are a steady and reasonably easy source of controversy for the press. They're always there for a soundbite when you want them.
And it won't be an innocuous soundbite either.
That's another thing that's happened over the past 10, 20, 30 years that kind of bothers me is the shrillness, the ad hominem attacks, the hyperbole. You know, they want to get their quote in the Washington Post or the Sacramento Bee or the New York Times. And it becomes kind of a game, and I just didn't want to play that game anymore. I got tired of that.
Have you suddenly become the darling of the political right, the Republicans trying to woo you as the poster child for finally looking into the evil core of this special interest group?
Well, there was a little bit of that after the stories ran. All of it, unsolicited, sort of astonishing. I had nothing to do with it, but it has been a peculiar phenomenon to be temporarily popular among that crowd.
And how about hate mail? Are you getting, like, Birkenstocks thrown through your window?
It's interesting. You know, I'm getting a little bit of that, some from the Sierra Club, some from elsewhere. But what's fascinating is if you sift through the emails, there are a number from environmental CEOs who say, in effect, you know, I'll be tarred and feathered for saying this, but your stories were right on. It's time that somebody took a good, hard look at what's going on. These people talk about the influence of marketing and conservation when they go out to dinner at night and when they talk among themselves. I'm getting the focus because I took that debate public. Therefore, you know, there's a bit of the attack the messenger element to this, which is fine. I don't mind that. I think that's what a journalist should do. But those who are criticizing me should realize that the very issues I raise are very much live issues inside the movement itself.
Well, Tom Knudsen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Knudsen is a reporter for the Sacramento Bee.
morning, Don Imus reaches hundreds of thousands of listeners on 90 stations. He is simulcast on MSNBC. In one part of his show, Imus hosts highbrow discussions of politics and culture with America's media elite. In the other part, he revels in sex and potty jokes and routinely offends blacks, gays, and women.
Matter of fact, both teams played most of the game like a bunch of polio-stricken bitches last night. Matter of fact, the Knicks got booed more in their own house than Rosie O'Donnell in the live sex show, Imus, man.
Taken all together, the I-Man is a gold-plated paradox. He is a tastemaker completely lacking in taste. Back in May of last year, something remarkable happened on Imus in the Morning. Clarence Page, the Washington columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a regular guest on the classy part of the show, asked Imus to take a pledge.
Are you raising your hand here?
I have it up.
Okay, number one, I, Don Imus. Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will promise to cease all simian references to black athletes.
That I will promise to cease all simian references to black athletes.
A ban on all references to non-criminal blacks as thugs, pimps, muggers, and Colt 45 drinkers.
I promise to do that.
Very good. How about an end to Amos and Andy Cutts, comparison of New York City to Mogadishu, and all parodies of black voices unless they are done by a black person, because you're really not very good at it.
I think Bernard should be doing this.
Should have his Bernard, where are you?
The pledge was inevitably and immediately broken. But for Page, that wasn't the point. The point was to make his position clear. He liked being on the serious part of Imus in the Morning, but he didn't want his presence to imply endorsement of the outrages committed in the other part.
I personally feel that I and other pundits should not go on if we have serious objections to some of the show's material, unless Don does give us the opportunity to address those concerns, as he did with me. Now, why I haven't been invited on the show since, I don't know. I haven't troubled myself to call and ask.
No, Page hasn't been invited back. He no longer, at least for the time being, stands with his peers, Tim Russert and Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather and Jeff Greenfield, Cokie Roberts and Mike Wallace and Frank Rich, and all the other stars in the journalistic firmament who regularly talk to the I-Man.
It appears that Don Imus owns the media establishment.
Philip Nobile is a man with a mission. With a nod to the relentless police inspector in Les Miserables, he calls himself Don Imus's Javert. He seeks not only to capture Imus, he conceived the pledge administered by Page, but to indict the pundits who make Imus respectable.
The journalists who are members of Don Imus's entourage obviously have too much at stake to join me in calling Imus on his vicious bigotry. They sell their books. They announce their project. They play the Imus game.
They appear on a program that makes fun of Janet Reno's Parkinson's disease and refers to Oprah Winfrey as a fat, flatulent cow. And it doesn't seem to bother them.
The reason I go on his show is very, very simple.
Frank Rich is a New York Times columnist and a regular on Imus in the Morning.
It's the only show I know of in commercial broadcasting that I've been on where you can actually talk in an informed way, not in sound bites, about the issue of the day with someone with whom you can match wits and who really knows his stuff. For the space when he's talking to a journalist or a politician or an author, you know, it plays to me like Terry Gross, quite frankly.
If the serious parts are Terry Gross, then the satire, according to Rich, is closer to Alfred E. Newman.
It plays as the sometimes juvenile speech at the level of, say, Mad Magazine or Paul Krasner's The Realist, which is what it aspires to in hits and misses. I don't feel by appearing on the show that I'm endorsing the worst offenders, but also I feel in the context of entertainment, to me, it plays in context in the show. It doesn't play as hate speech.
Lick on a lady tonight. Lick on a lady tonight.
The wanton lust of an attorney general for a secretary who provided human services.
Little ditty about Janet and Donna.
Earlier this summer, one of Imus's second bananas, Sid Rosenberg, made a joke in shockingly bad taste about tennis players Serena and Venus Williams. Imus fired him and then promptly rehired him. He explained that back in the bad old days of his own drug and alcohol abuse, people gave him about 50 second chances. Imus is all about forgiveness. But he admitted in an interview with Mike Wallace a few years back that he hired his staff to make racist jokes.
You told Tom Anderson, the producer, in your car coming home, that Bernard McGurk is there to do nigger jokes.
Well, I never used that word.
Tom?
I'm right here.
Did I use that word?
I recall you using that word.
Oh, okay, well, then I used that word. But I mean, of course, that was an off-the-record conversation.
The hell it was.
It drives Philip Nobile to distraction that Imus can admit to using that word on 60 Minutes and Larry King's show and suffer no consequences.
You can never underestimate the lack of intellectual honesty of America's media establishment.
The media establishment might counter with the charge that Nobile underestimates Don Imus. It's not just Imus's audience that's so appealing. It's Imus's attitude, liberating to both the beer before breakfast set and the political elite. This bad boy has a big tent. Mike Wallace.
There's a lot more to Imus than sophomoric and bigoted talk. A lot more. As I said, he reads, he thinks. He has an audience in Washington, I know, of all manner of, I hate to use the word important people, but in effect they are people in the establishment there. And they listen. It's a kind of club, in effect. It's early morning shaving in the mirror, taking your mind off your troubles talk. What you're doing when you listen to that kind of thing, or go on, and you're not going after votes.
What are you going after?
Public recognition of a sort. That's the world we live in, Ms. Gladstone.
And especially the public recognition of his elusive audience of sports-minded men. Nobody, with the exception of Nobile, seems to want to carry the flag on the Imus issue. Hardly anyone would speak to us, including Imus. Mr. Wallace says that the I-man has an extraordinarily thin skin. He's very lucky, then, to be surrounded by such a thick phalanx of powerful friends.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katja Rogers, engineered by Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.